The Art of the Song. I'm John Dillon.
And this is Vivian Nesbitt from Taos, New Mexico. Roger Landis joins us this week. Roger, whose guitar and bouzouki playing has been described as magnetic and soulful, is an acclaimed instrumentalist, composer, and teacher of Celtic music. Well, we are delighted this fine day in Taos to be in the studio with Roger Landis, founder of Zoukfest, which is a huge festival for bouzouki and guitar and fiddle and vocals, and also just a virtuoso musician on guitar and bouzouki. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you just give us an account of how you got started, where you're from physically, musically?
I grew up about 20-some miles east of Kansas City, Missouri. Did most of my growing up in the 60s and 70s. And I think maybe the Monkees were the first pop group on my radar. And then I quickly went from there to CCR, you know, Creedence Clearwater Revival. And from there to the Allman Brothers. And then I had a long period that I try not to talk about where I was really into progressive rock groups like Yes and Genesis. Kind of a dark secret. People don't want to really hear about that anymore. But
should we edit that part out of this particular?
If this were a TV program, this is where you'd put the black stripe across my eyes. And alter my voice.
That's right. I kind of get fuzzy. Yeah. I don't recall hearing a bouzouki or classical guitar or any of that in Yes or Genesis. How did that leap happen?
Years later, after I was already playing the bouzouki, I realized that there was an instrument that Steve Howe in Yes played that he called a vachalia. That was actually the maker's name. What it was a Puerto Rican cuatro. It's a 10-string instrument, kind of shaped like a violin, but with flattened top and back and short scale. You know, it's tuned like if you capoed your guitar to the 5th fret and took off the bottom string, it would be that tuning. And he used it on a couple of their songs in an open tuning, not the traditional tuning at all for the quattro, and had this really cool pseudo-medieval sound that I think stuck in my ear, even though I didn't really make that connection when I first got interested in Irish traditional music. I was in college, 1981, and heard a radio show, a local radio show in Kansas City, then sought out the two guys that were doing the radio show, and they played in a band together, and one of them played this instrument that he called a cittern. That's actually an older instrument that's quite different, a Renaissance and Baroque instrument. But some people use that for the modern instrument. But I got really interested in Irish traditional music. And because I was already a guitarist and studying classical guitar and had the whole strings and frets thing in my head, I thought, well, I'll go for the fretted instrument that isn't the guitar. So I went for the bouzouki. You know, hit it off with it. Then I branched out into mandolin and tenor banjo, which the Irish tune an octave below the mandolin. So you can use fiddle fingerings. Learned a lot of tunes and played in a band. And it's been downhill ever since.
What was the name of the band?
The band was called Scarta Glen, which is the name of a town, a tiny little crossroads town in County Kerry. After the band had been in existence for about 10 years, I've made it over to Ireland and went to that village and went in a pub and gave them a copy of the cassette with the name on there. And they looked at me like, oh, yeah. And they put it on and they I think they liked it, but they thought it was cool that we knew their music.
Did you play when you were there?
Yeah.
How was it?
It was great. I went with Kirk Lynch, who was in the band. Great musician. Now he makes his living as a pipe maker. He's one of the foremost Illan pipe makers in the world. We went by this pub after a disappointing attempt to find some traditional music in Killarney, which was the other direction. And I asked the publican behind the bar, I said, is there any music in town tonight? And he says, what kind of music? I said, traditional music. He said, why would you be wanting that? I said, well, you know, we play a bit. And he says, oh, you do? I said, where are your instruments? And I said, well, they're out in the boot, you know, using the correct term for trunk. And he says, well, while I'm drawing your pints, go get them. So we went out and got our instruments, came back in. And the kind of slow turning around and looking at us that happened when we first walked in was a much longer kind of double take from all the people at the bar when we walked in and they saw Kirk putting together a set of pipes. And so we tuned up. And because we were in that region of Ireland, the Cork Kerry border, which is famous for, they tend to play polkas and slides, as they would say, as opposed to the much more common reels and jigs that you hear. They have a really distinctive style of music. And we had a couple of polkas that a friend of ours had written in Kansas City. So perversely, we played them. We knew that they would know that we could play and we knew what we were doing, but they wouldn't have had a clue where those tunes came from. And so we did that. And as soon as we stopped, everybody came over and started asking us questions. Like, where did you get your music? You know, one older fellow was asking Kirk about the pipes and he says, what's your name? And Kirk said, Lynch. And he says, your family's from Ireland. He says, yes. And he says, well, how long ago? And Kirk says, oh, I don't know. Probably about five generations. And the old fellow says, five generations and they still have the pipes. And completely misunderstanding that Kirk didn't take up Irish music until he was in his late 20s. Because we were good at it, they assumed that we grew up with it. Right. Which was a really nice, you know, assumption for them to have made.
When did you start writing your original tunes?
I guess, technically, the first original tune I ever wrote was one that I actually dreamed. I dreamed a tune when I was living in Kansas City, and it was my first summer playing Irish music. I was taking a nap, and you know how sometimes you take a nap in the afternoon and it's a very fertile dream field. And I woke up and I had this tune in my head, so I wrote it down. And it wasn't a very good tune, but it was my tune. It's not one I would play particularly today, but it fit the form. Looking back on it, I guess it meant that I was beginning to understand something about Irish music, if I could write a tune that would fit within the style. And then 4 or 5 years later, maybe something like that, I wrote a jig, which I ended up putting on my record.
That's Dragon Reels.
Yeah. And the jig is called A Barrel of Knives. That was the first reel tune that I wrote. And then there's a couple of other original tunes. A reel that I named after my grandfather, who was a pretty well-known horseman. Everybody knew him as Uncle Dick. It was Uncle Dick's reel. Thank you.
Roger Landis with his original Uncle Dick's Slow Reel from his CD Dragon Reels.
One of the things we are curious about is where songs come from. When you typically sit down to write, do you have an idea in mind or do you wait until inspiration strikes and then, oh, I got to write this down and then go from there?
Usually I don't sit down with the idea that I'm going to create something right now, musically. It just sort of happens. There's been one exception to that. I was, right after I moved to Taos, I broke my ankle. I was in a cast for 3 months, but it happened about 3 weeks before Christmas time, and so I couldn't work. So it was lean times. So for Christmas gifts, I sat down and I wrote like 7 tunes in a week and then printed them out and framed them and gave them to people. And that's the only time I've ever sat down with the express purpose of creating a melody. And it was pretty productive, so I should probably do it more often. But usually I'll wait till I get an idea and I just go grab an instrument and play it and see if it actually works. Then I usually remember it. Sometimes I'll sit down on my computer and quickly write it out on the computer so it's preserved.
Irish music is one of the most complex forms to truly play well. Can you talk about how you've managed to internalize that?
Yeah, the process is very simple. The results are not simple. Just by playing with other people. It really can't be transmitted in writing. You know, this notation we've been talking about is just the barest skeleton of a melody. It doesn't give you all the missing elements that can't be written down. And the only way to get that is by listening and playing, more listening than playing at first, and playing with people who are a lot better than you are. If your knowledge base is sound, you know, if you've got the tunes and you understand the structure of the music, then that's where your learning really begins, in the playing of it and playing it with lots of different people. And because it's largely, well, I hesitate to use the word improvised because that has so many other implications and other styles of music. You have a given melody line, which you vary it somewhat, but mainly you vary it in the way you play it and the way you ornament it, the way you decorate it. Sometimes you change the melody line, but in Irish music, you don't really ever take breaks like they do in bluegrass music. Mm-hmm.
You don't give the solo over to somebody, right. to another right. instrument, another melody instrument that can...
Really, every melody instrument is soloing all the time at the same time, is the way that it works. Now, of course, in order for that not to be a mess, everybody has to be pretty much on the same page. So it's not like, you know, there are certain kinds of jazz where everybody's soloing all the time. But this is a very different thing. The level of improvisation is at a really discrete level. You're changing very small things, but within the context of that style, they're huge. So, I mean, changing one note in a tune can be huge. I think the thing that attracted me to it, when I first heard Irish music, it was a record by the Chieftains. The name of the album was Boil the Breakfast Early, and, you know, I'd never heard anything like that. It's like, what a phrase, and I found out later it's the name of a tune, you know? There's a whole folklore of tune titles in Irish music. At first listening, I didn't like it very much. And then I went back to it, and it started to grow on me. And at the time, I had been listening to lots of medieval and Renaissance music, whatever I could find on recording, and particularly the medieval dance music recordings I could find that were directed by this guy named Thomas Binkley, who was a genius in the early music field. I remember thinking in my really naive way that the Irish music sounded like the medieval music had been preserved in this little corner of Europe. And now there were people playing it and making records of it. So I thought there was a direct link. There are some links, but what it has in common is actually the texture of the music. It's what they call monody as opposed to polyphony. It's one melody line with some sort of accompaniment. It can be chords, or it could be a drone, or it could be a drum. The music itself consists almost entirely of the melody. And that's the way Irish music is. You can add accompaniment to it. You can add percussion to it. You can add other melodic instruments playing harmonies. But really what it reduces to, you can reduce it to a melody line and it's still complete.
You mentioned earlier that Irish music can be notated and written down, but it's only a part of the picture. And I'd like to try to get a little more understanding of what it is. Is it an emotional quality? You mentioned ornamentation. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's several things, and the emotional quality is definitely one of them. There's a feeling that Irish traditional players have when they play, and they all recognize it in other players, and there's variations on it. I mean, it varies from player to player. Mm-hmm. Having been in college and studied linguistics, I talk about music and the teaching and learning of music in linguistic terms a lot because a lot of the functions are the same. It's like learning to speak that language with the kind of accent that will allow you to fit in. Because it is, it's all about community. That's what that music is all about. You can put Irish music on a stage, you can arrange it, you can put, you know, didgeridoos behind it, and you can make a show out of it. You know, we've all seen probably enough of that. What it really is music that people make together in really informal ways in terms of anything to do with the marketplace, mm-hmm. anything to do with media. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, it's really at its most real, most authentic. When, you know, two people are playing in their kitchen or a few people are playing in the local pub, the amazing thing that's happened with that music in the last 20 some years is that you can go to just about any major metropolitan center in the world. You can go to Tokyo and not speak a word of Japanese, and you can go have an Irish session with Japanese people who can play that music. You can do it in Germany. You could actually, you know, fly to a different city every night, girding the globe, and have a real Irish session every night. It's an amazing thing that's happened. At the same time, there's been a commercialization, or a word I like to use is the commodification. It becomes a commodity and it gets sold. And that what happens is that changes it. That makes it something other than what it is. Where Irish traditional music really works is when the people who play it are playing for each other. There's a community to that. And then there are other people who are part of that community who don't play, but they understand how that whole system works. So they're there too. And then there are singers, which, you know, in Irish traditional music, singing is usually separate from playing instruments. Nowadays, they combine them. Folk groups would combine them. But it traditionally, or I should say, the most traditional style of Irish singing was unaccompanied. Mm-hmm. It's a style called Shan Nós, which means the old way mm-hmm. in Irish.
Is here Cashan gan break gan doubt Tánan hiún tish fóna.
There's this great thing that used to happen. I've seen it happen. I haven't seen it for years, but in pubs where whoever the session leader is, and there isn't always a session leader, but generally there's someone who's respected by most everyone there to whom they defer. That's kind of the way the hierarchy works. But often the session leader or one of the respected elder people in the situation will ask a singer to sing a song. And then everyone, they hush everyone in the pub.
They shush the pub.
Yeah. Mm. And usually it's as soon as the singer opens his or her mouth, you'll hear, you know, quiet back there, you know. And then you can hear a pin drop. Well, often the singer will turn away from the people and face the wall so that the emphasis is put on the song and not on the singer, because that's one of the values in traditional Irish music is that it's not really the singer or the player. It's the song or the tune. And that's all that, you know, I mean, we're all going to be in the ground and some people will remember us, but what matters is the tune that continues or the song that continues from generation to generation. And that's what they're respecting. And that's really different than a lot of music that I grew up with. So when I got deep enough into Irish traditional music to see those kinds of values, I really connected with that. It really moved me and pulled me in further. And mm-hmm. since then I've discovered that there are other musics like that too.
We'll be right back with more from Roger Landis. You're listening to Art of the Song.
Information regarding transcripts, CDs, DVDs, and our special Creativity Blend coffee may be found at the Creativity Store on our website, artofthesong.org. Welcome back. We're talking with instrumentalist Roger Landis.
So a lot of the music is traditional. That is, melodies that have been around for centuries. How are new compositions viewed?
They're generally welcomed and really, really valued if they fit the style. I have in my repertoire probably a couple of hundred tunes or more that I don't know about that were composed in the 20th century. Often these tunes are so traditional that the people who play them don't know who composed them. And so there are people within this tradition who kind of keep track of that folklore about who wrote which tune, or which tune is associated with which musician. He may not have written it, but he might as well have, because it's so much a part of his style and his persona and his memory within the tradition. You'll see on the internet occasionally somebody's getting ready to record a tune they think is traditional, or if they're making a record, they'll list all their tunes in an email message and ask all the really experienced people on this list if any of them are original and do I need to obtain permissions. The vast majority of musicians in the tradition who compose would be delighted, overjoyed, and bowled over if you ask permission to record one of their tunes. And if you ask them, where do I send the royalty check? They'll tell you not to bother, because that's not the point. And some people would be offended by that. Usually you kind of ask through friends, because if somebody would like to be paid, you don't want to offend them by acting like not paying them, but you don't want to offend them by offering to give them money for something that's not about money.
That was McNeese Crossing, an unreleased track by Roger Landis. The name refers to a crossing on the Santa Fe Trail near Clayton, New Mexico.
I'm really struck by this image of going around the globe to all the major cities and actually being able to sit down in a real Irish session. It says something to me about the craving that we have as a species to connect.
Yes.
And connect in a very raw, very pure, complex form.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's really amazing. That societies that don't come from that tradition would grab onto this. It's like the blues. It's
yes,
like a
it is.
You know, it has that same kind of connection.
Well, there's, you know, there's been a concurrent commodification and commercialization mm-hmm. of Irish music, as you know, mm-hmm. that has been having the same time, but it doesn't seem to have any major effects on the tradition. Small effects maybe, but you know, certain tunes that come from the commercial sphere might have some sort of currency for a brief time within traditional sessions if they're fun to play. It remains to be seen if they're going to stick. Because the thing about the tradition is that it's really broad and it's consensual. I used to get in arguments with people about folk rock bands, you know, destroying the music, they'd say, you know, with the bass and drums. Well, yeah, I mean, that has happened a lot, but it only destroys the music while they're, you know, their music, their Irish music while they're doing it. From that point of view, it doesn't do anything to the music itself and what other people are going to do. This is consensual. It's a conversation. All points of view are valid and see what happens in the end. There are some scholars that will argue that the tradition can be damaged, but I don't believe that. I think the tradition is only damaged by people not choosing to participate in it. It's like a language dying out. If people want to speak that language, then they will. So far, that musical language was preserved in Ireland, and because it's kind of a model for what traditional musics all over Europe were at one time.
So, Roger, what would you say is the best way to get inside Irish music?
I draw an analogy with language, because sometimes it helps to take something that we find very familiar and apply it to something that unfamiliar. The analogy I would draw is that if you decided you wanted to speak French, and you studied for a few weeks and had a basic vocabulary about how to get something to eat, how to go to the bathroom, how to change money, how to avoid missing your flight from Paris, you could go to Paris and have a fantastic time. But you couldn't go to a meeting of French poets and improvise French poetry with them. You're not there yet. That's like playing Irish music at its level. You have complete command of the vocabulary and grammar, and you're fluent, meaning that you can do it in real time. So that means that you can converse, because that's really what it is. It's a musical conversation. If you take the music on its own terms, and if you approach it the way the people who belong to that music do, then it goes much quicker. I've been teaching for over 20 years, and frequently the challenge that particularly adult students have is learning how not to hear Irish music. I mean, in other words, hearing what it isn't, because a lot of what we hear is filtered through a prism of our experience. And our experience in America, you know, with pop culture and with the traditional musics that are here in the United States, is radically different than Irish music. It's also radically different than Middle Eastern music or Greek music or Turkish music or, you know, lots of other things. I try to invite people to take out of their hearing the things that aren't in Irish music, but which they're imposing on it.
Advice to somebody who is looking to ramp up their creativity or their sense of involvement in life?
Two things from my experience that I would suggest might be valuable. One is learning to participate in a musical community, which seems alien, is a really good thing. It's not something that happens very often in the United States. I think that's one of the reasons why you were picking up on what I said about being able to play in an Irish session almost in any major metropolitan area on the globe. I think that's why, is that the opportunities for that have been limited. I mean, I think with the advent of radio and recording, people stopped playing music for their own enjoyment and started viewing it more as a product. You know, there's a lot of great music that's been made as a product. We all love the Beatles and people like that. But there's another kind of music, and there's another kind of musical experience that's more about where you're from and who you live next to and how you relate. It's not just about what you think or what you want. It's about what is there, what's already existing. And do you want to have that be part of your life? That's a really beautiful thing to be involved in. Mm-hmm. You'll get things from people from having that experience with them that you could get in no other way. Also, the experience of learning how other cultures experience their music, how they think about it, how they approach it, what their attitude is when they pick up an instrument or, you know, take in a breath, they're going to sing, what they think music does as opposed to what we're used to thinking it does here in the States. It really is the only universal human language. I mean, that's why they put it on Voyager, you know, when they shot it out to space. I mean, you could put 1,000 human languages on there, but you can put the one that's truly universal, and there's a chance that some alien creatures that find it are going to, you know, rock out.
Roger Landis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me.